sports are back. Thank you. Thank you, sports, for returning. Toronto Blue Jays baseball tonight. Arizona Diamondbacks in town. And we get a roster announcement from Canada Basketball. I'll talk a little bit about that later. But I want to start with a couple of Jays thoughts as they return to the Rogers Centre. Feels like forever since they've actually been here. So I'm going to try to get down to the ballpark this week before I take a little bit of time off and head to Seattle, along with the Blue Jays, actually. So the big story coming up this weekend is going to be Dalton Varsho. It's going to be Dalton Varsho in the trade. Everybody is going to have their thoughts on the trade, and so here are mine as it stands right now. Okay, so clearly it started off horrifically. It just did. Gurriel's at the All-Star game. The Blue Jays desperately needed right-handed power. Gurriel has absolutely done that in spades. They have a catcher in Alejandro Kirk who, when I was speaking with Ennis yesterday, we talked about it. He has been a below-average hitter now for a calendar year, which is kind of a nightmare when you consider that Gabriel Moreno is a better defensive player. He's younger, and he's a better hitter to contact right now. But this weekend is going to be massive in terms of the way we start talking about this narrative. At least I think. A baseball season's so busy, it's so full, we're going to have the deadline, the Blue Jays have so much pressure on them, the fans desperately want to see them start to win ball games, and so ultimately that's going to take by far, center stage with all of this. But I am kind of curious to see what happens here with Varsho, with Moreno, and with Gurriel this weekend. Because, all right, let's just break this down as it is right now. I was not a huge fan of the trade when it happened. I liked Dalton Varsho, the player. I was over watching Gurriel's defense, like many of you. I also agreed that the Blue Jays needed to make a change. And with Gurriel's name in trade rumors for the last couple of years, it had always felt like an inevitability that he was going to get dealt. What I didn't really expect with Gurriel is that he felt like a throw-in with this trade, that they felt like they had to throw him in as a bonus. Because when he had been in rumors the couple of years before, it was always about how cheap this guy's contract was and the fact that he did have those couple of years of control. And it was always, hey, Gurriel is the looming piece. The Jays might end up trading him. The Jays might use him as the sweetener in on big contracts or big trade swings. And then so for him to get thrown into a deal for Dalton Varsho, a guy who was, you know, good, had a good career in Arizona, but wasn't exactly someone that I think most baseball fans knew. It seemed a little strange, especially given that Toronto was giving up their top prospect, and it felt like the last significant move that they could make. It also felt a little bit like they struck out in free agency, that they missed out on being able to move some other pieces around in left field or in the outfield in general, and so that they had to make a trade like that. And that always scared me a little bit. But I welcome the trade with the idea of, okay, Varsho is all of these things that people are going to outline, and he's delivered on a lot of them, right? He's actually the leader in defensive runs saved right now, which is why when you go look at his Fangraphs or his baseball reference pages, he's actually on baseball reference a little ahead of Gurriel when it comes to war, a little bit behind him, well, a decent amount behind him on Fangraphs war, which, as I'm learning, is the one that you're really supposed to use for position players. But that is because that defensive run save metric, he has been brilliant in doing this. There is, I don't want to say a maturity to Varsho, but there's a gamesmanship there. He's clearly a ball player. He's a guy who has a bit of understanding for situations, and the effort level with him seems to be consistent across the board, which is 100%. He is just giving 100%, 100% of the time. That part of it has been great. Base running stuff too. When he gets on, he feels like a threat. He's a smart base runner. It's something that this team needed. And you do feel like when he's on first base, you're a threat to score, which, you know, Toronto isn't exactly full of a bunch of speedsters. I think that was a little overstated. Remember during spring training when it was the idea of, oh, wow, now there's a whole bunch of guys that can steal bases. And Whit Merrifield throughout his career has been a demon on the base paths. And Kiermaier's going to do it. And Vlad, you know, we always have the Vlad thing in spring, blah, 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 blah. Nah, didn't really pan out. But Varsho always feels super scary on the bases. Problem is that he's gone back into a bit of a swoon to start July after we saw him starting to come out of the funk. And the reason that I was never thrilled about the trade, why I was never over the moon about it, why I never thought the Blue Jays won the trade, is because you want to get guys in a deal like that, regardless of control, regardless of the defense, whatever. Like, those two things are fine. Those two things feel a lot easier to get, though. Right? Like, you can get a good defensive outfielder. The Blue Jays went and got Jackie Bradley Jr. off the scrap heaps last year. And obviously, Varsho is a more competent hitter than he is. Fine. But I've never been a big believer in, like, you make a huge trade for a guy that is just a defensive player, or that's the thing that is the leading... It's in the lead sentence when you're talking about acquiring him. So the defensive runs saved have been terrific, but the Blue Jays' story of the season, one of them, I guess, has been a bit the defensive outfield, but it's been that they haven't been able to cash runners in scoring position. And Dalton Varsho has been, yeah, really rough at the plate. He had a nice June, 765 OPS. It's the only month this season where he has an OPS plus over 100. That part of it is a little bit difficult to process. And if we're talking about upside with the bat, that was a part of the Varsho thing, was people went, hey, he's going to be able to hit lefties better. There's some evidence here that he's going to be able to do that. Well, so far this season, he has no home runs against left-handed pitching. Again, that's in like 70 plate appearances or something. But either way, it's not an overly encouraging number. His signature offensive play so far has been the bunt, which is kind of fun, knowing it's coming, and when he's able to execute it, great. 12 home runs, pretty underwhelming. We thought that this guy was going to have major power. We thought that this guy was going to put it over the fences at the Rogers Center, that they basically reconfigured to help out with left-handed hitters. But yeah, to start July, in 26 plate appearances, he's batting under 100. His on-base percentage is 115. It's nothing, but I do feel like this series is going to be important for this narrative. What does Dalton Varsho look like head-to-head against the players that he was traded for? If Gurriel comes in the Rogers Center and hits two home runs over the next three games, and Varsho strikes out a bunch at the plate, I think people are going to start to grumble about this thing. If Varsho makes a bunch of spectacular plays in the outfield, as he is one to do, and Gurriel Jr. continues to be a guy that's in a bit of a slump, who's done that for the last month, same with Gabriel Moreno, both those guys have been down in the dumpsters. It's allowed Varsho and those two guys to sort of normalize. Yeah, I think that people are going to start to get a little bit frustrated with the deal, and they're going to talk about the deal a little bit more. But either way, I think that Varsho has caught himself in a very nice spot here. Blue Jays have a little bit of momentum. Gurriel's in a bit of a slump. Moreno's in a slump. And if Varsho can just put a couple of games together here, a couple of decent games together here, it could go a long way to reminding people that, all right, maybe this trade isn't going to end up ever being a slam dunk over-the-moon success for the Blue Jays. But he is someone who's going to be under contract here for a couple of years, and he might still be more conducive to helping them win than those two guys were this season. That has to be the thing. Because I was asking people about this yesterday. Can you win the Varsho trade if Moreno doesn't pan out to be all that good of a player, but Gurriel has a monster season in your must-now window, and Varsho just ends up being this? I don't know. I honestly don't know. Either way, all eyes are on these guys this weekend, but it would be really, really great, really, really great if, while his former team is in town, Dalton Varsho could hit a home run, maybe even two, have himself a weekend, put together some good plate appearances, help this Blue Jays team score some runs, and, yeah, do it against a couple of guys that are mostly hidden away, that we do see the numbers for, that we don't really ever talk about the slide when it comes to these two, like I mentioned, the last 6 weeks, the last month for Lourdes Gurriel Jr. I'm a big believer in the way that these things impact things. I do think that there has been some resonance of the pressure of the trade on Dalton Varsho, and I do wonder how far it would go for him if he was able to put together a great weekend against his old team. Anyways, I've got Ariel Helwani here. Taped an interview with him yesterday. Hit on Knicks, Canada soccer, which he loves, and of course the Francis Ngannou Tyson Fury super fight. Here it is.
All right, so it's Ariel Helwani. So yeah, thank you for doing me this favor. Thank you for coming on the show. We've never done the Zoom before, so this is interesting getting to see you behind, you know, or in front of the famous Helwani bookshelf. My bookshelf, like, far less impressive.
No, well, yours is real and mine's fake, so you get major points for that. Is that a shofar behind you over there? Are you Jewish? Are you secretly Jewish?
It's a doll sheep horn.
Oh, that's what a shofar is.
Oh, yeah. Well, but it's not a horn, though. It's just I thought a shofar you blow into.
Yeah,
it's noise. No, that's not like a horn. It's like, it's just a horn. Like a doll sheep horn from its head. My dad shot it.
Wow. That is that is hardcore. But the shofar, by the way, is something that comes from a sheep, and then I think somehow they create a hole in it. In any event, here's why I just did you a massive favor and why you should be thanking me. Number one, you always have me on the show, and you always like put me in a box. Like, it has to be at 9 a.m. Like, who's available at 9 a.m., you know, especially someone with kids? Yeah. I'm never available, yet you keep asking, and I appreciate the persistence. Now you're able to do the interview at any time.
Yeah.
And of course, we are doing this live just for the audience at home, so they don't think that this is a pre-tape and they're getting the
product. Definitely not.
But also, now I can see you. Yeah. And most importantly, the audio is infinitely better. When I do the phoners, audio sounds like crap. It sounds like a 1980 radio interview. Like, what is this? This is way better.
I do my best to try and have it live because I do think that there's an element to the
radio. This is live.
Exactly. There's something to having the radio show and the podcast blend into kind of one thing that I've always sort of felt, I don't want to say is my own, but it's something that I always really wanted to do. Like, from the early outset of my career, I wanted to be a podcast host, but I love the feeling of, if you make a mistake on this thing, that it's live, that there's no going back, that this isn't a streaming service, that this is on the Fan 590. And so I always wanted the podcast sound, but still with the blend of radio and the ability to act to something live. And so, to me, I think the scary thing always with the pre-tape is that the next morning something happens and then I got to ditch it. And then I go, this doesn't go anywhere. It gets tacked on to maybe the end of my podcast, and that sucks. And yeah, man, I love our conversations, and you're one of the biggest names that does this show, right? So
consistently, I mean, it's almost like every week at this point. I feel like it should be like the JD and Ariel podcast at this point.
Listen, I thought we were gonna do that, but you know, that was your fault. That didn't.
Nah, not really my fault. Yeah. Yeah, wow.
Yeah, exactly.
Is this a shoot right now, or is this kayfabe?
It's not a shoot. That's kayfabe. Okay, so a couple things. One is, I got to tell you, just speaking of kids in the morning, I spent the entire afternoon with Ennis today and his kids at the aquarium. I don't know how you guys do it and have careers. Like, I genuinely do not understand how anyone can be in this line of work and then also have children. Would you like to explain how you became famous but also have kids? Because, like, I was with them for 3-4 hours this afternoon at the aquarium. By the time I left there, all I wanted to do was go to sleep.
I know. It is exhausting. Is that the one across from Rogers Center?
Yeah.
The Ripley's one?
Yeah, it's aptly named with Rip. You know, like, it's...
I don't get it.
Yeah, rip off. Get it?
Oh. I went there when I was there in October for the ill-fated playoff game. It was fun with the kids. I actually just had this conversation 24 hours ago with a friend of mine who's not in the media business but is trying to create his own thing and, you know, might as well be in the media business. And he is around my age, so he's in his early 40s, and he doesn't have any kids, and he got married a few years ago. And I was like, when are you going to have kids? He's like, no, not this year. This is not the year for it. And I told him, man, it's always going to be that. Next year, you'll have another set of things that you'll need to concentrate on, that you won't want any distractions. It's not the year for it. And here's the beauty, and here's the secret of it all. It's never going to be a perfect time, right? Because we all are so conceited and egomaniacs and focused on our careers and just want to succeed. And we can't even fathom the idea of something coming in the way of that and messing it all up. Like, we'll get married, but we can't even fathom the idea of splitting up our attention spans and our time and all that stuff. And here's the actual truth that a lot of people won't tell you, but this is the truth. The best thing to happen to your career would be to have kids. Why? Because kids will give you balance. They will give you perspective. They will give you a distraction. I said to my friend yesterday, I think that I crumble and fail and don't make it to whatever point that I am at today or will be at without my kids, because I would have been so obsessed with my career and so focused and overanalyzing things and looking at my phone and computer and thinking about things 24/7. Kids force you to think of something else, force you to do something else. They force you to go to soccer games. They force you to do things outside. They force you to go to the pool, whatever it is. I would never do that if I didn't have kids. So the truth is they are a blessing and they are great. They are a great like distraction and give you great balance and perspective because you're so focused on your career and getting by and all that. And that is great. But if you got kids, I guarantee you, you'd be hosting drive time, Leafs pregame, postgame, doing play by play, doing Raptors, all that stuff. If you had the kids, believe that.
You just made me feel a whole new low because I felt this yesterday when there's no sports on TV this week. And
not true.
Well, kind
All-Star
of
game.
Like, yeah, the All-Star game doesn't count. It's hard.
Fighting. There's a lot of combat.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about a little bit of that, but I would say I just kind of have the Pavlovian dog effect where it's 7 o'clock and I go towards the television because that's where I like will generate content from. And I didn't have any social plans last night. And so I just sort of went to the TV and sat there and was like, well, I guess I'll watch a movie. I was like, what am I supposed to do with this time? I worked out and I watched a movie. That's what I ended up doing. Actually, I watched Eastbound and Down, which the first episode of that might be the greatest pilot episode of any television show in history. Like it's so incredibly good. You've seen it, right?
I'm not really into it. I saw it like many moons ago,
really,
but no,
it's
not
hard
really
to hold up
it.
And watch it in today's context. Like it was only filmed, I want to say 10 years ago.
It was like
but
a little too silly. It's sort of like that NASCAR movie with Will Ferrell. Not into that one either.
Oh, I love that movie, Talladega Nights.
No, not
I'm
into
too
it.
Too drunk but to eat, taste this chicken. That line.
No,
oh,
not
I,
my
I,
thing. Oh, but I'll tell you what. I haven't watched a series. You know, everyone's binging shows now. That's their big thing. But this is a sports story, if you will. I haven't watched a series in years and years and years. My two boys are at summer camp, and I was kind of bored at like 10 o'clock. And you know what I started watching? And now I watched 2.5 episodes, and I got to the point where I'm like, I'm excited for the next one. That's when you know that you're into it, right?
Oh, yeah.
Ted Lasso. Ted Lasso, not bad.
Yeah. So the first season of Ted Lasso is truly brilliant.
Okay.
And it was the show we needed during the pandemic, just this incredible pick-me-up. But it peters off harder than maybe any scene. Like by the I gave up on it in season 3. Like I just could not do it anymore. Like the relentless optimism of the show. And I know you'll laugh because you think I'm just being a pessimist, but it is. It just becomes too much. Like
no, I get that.
Yeah.
For now though, it's fun.
Yeah. Oh no. Listen, I think that first season of it, Sudeikis, you can put that role up. Like that is a famous, iconic role that he accomplished there. So I agree that. That is a very, very good one. I loved it. Man, I loved that first season. Right in pandemic, too, when everybody was sour and
sad. Is that
when
it came out? When did it come out? Do you remember? It was like
it dropped it in 2020. Like it came out. Yeah, it came out when everyone was down in the doldrums. And it was just like an online show where people could talk about positivity. It was great. Okay, so I got to ask you a Knicks question before we talk about the Francis stuff.
You ready? Yes.
And I'm sure people have asked you this as well. Why wouldn't the Knicks trade Jalen Brunson for Damian Lillard?
Off. Well, sorry.
No, you can leave it. We'll bleep it.
God.
Why wouldn't they do this? That's why. Like,
are
I
you
don't
insane?
I don't
understand. Absolutely out of your mind.
Like,
are you out
guy,
of your mind?
Well, but he came that much of a god that, like,
yes.
A year ago.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
He is beloved. I would argue he's probably one of the most beloved New York athletes right now. Who would I put in the category? Like Aaron Judge, maybe.
Yeah. For sure.
I mean, not Rodgers. Rodgers hasn't even played yet for the Jets. No one
I was
on the Rangers.
The Jet player right now feels like Sauce Gardner and the
Jacobs.
Athlete.
He is so beloved for so many reasons. Number one, his dad played for the Knicks. He is from the tri-state area. And while we didn't draft him, he does feel like somewhat of our own because he came to the Knicks after his rookie contract and he chose us. And on top of that, if you're a tremendous point guard in New York City, you are God. I mean, it's like quarterback for the Giants, Jets. Like, that's the job. That's the one.
You know what Damian Lillard plays, right?
Yes, but he's our guy. Why would we give away our guy to get another guy who isn't our guy? Yeah. And by the way, I love Damian Lillard. Sure. Shout out to Dame. DM buddy of mine, big fight fan.
Ooh.
We chat, and I would love nothing more than to have him on the Knicks, but not at the expense. I'll trade anyone for Damian except for Jalen, and that includes our boy RJ.
Okay, so this, of course, you would trade RJ, and like this is a fun hypothetical because Portland wouldn't even entertain it either. Because why would they go get Scoot Henderson and then have a smaller point guard that plays beside him? But I this is all I'm gonna ask is with the follow up is, don't you feel like this would have been the same kind of conversation the year prior when you guys all thought Julius Randle was the truth, and or 2 years ago? when there was the Julius Randle season, and everyone in New York was so obsessed with Julius Randle and most improved player, and he was our guy. And then a year later, he was like flipping offense at the Garden.
Julius is not Jalen.
Sure. My point is, though, is that sometimes we get enamored with these talents that aren't the top tier elite talent of the game. They resonate with us. And I honestly think that Toronto had this to a degree with Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan, where both guys were in that all-star tier, but not superstar tier, right? Lowry needed Kawhi Leonard to get it done. And if you would have asked Raptors fans the same question, Len, like if those two guys would have been their prime, would you trade Lowry for Dame? So many would have given the same answer as you, because they would have said the identity of the city. And as an outsider looking in, you go, that's nuts. Go get the guy who clearly has the higher floor, the higher ceiling. It's just, it's incredible to me that Jalen Brunson has become that to Knicks fans, where it's like,
he is.
Who would you trade for him? Like, what is the tier then? If it's not Damian Lillard, how many guys in the NBA would you rather have than Dame?
The other thing is, to your point, they play the same position.
Sure.
And one's a lot younger than the other, and one's a lot less banged up than the other. So, like, what is Jalen Brunson's ceiling at this point? Jalen Brunson's on Team USA, and I know
tall,
it's not,
that's his ceiling.
I know it's not the dream team, but like, Jalen Brunson should have been an all-star, and I suspect he will be in that conversation again. Ultimately, does he make the all-star team? Who knows? It's a lot of politics and weird stuff, but like, I think he's one of the I would put him in the top 30 discussion right now, maybe even 25 in the NBA. I think he's that darn good. And just look at what the Mavericks became without him, right? Like, what a mess of a situation they are. So I just want to do it because I just feel like you're trading for a guy who's older and a little bit more banged up than the other. And on top, you have the romance factor that he's our guy. I don't know. It doesn't make sense. By the way, everyone, like, I'm first to say it's time to say goodbye to Julius Randle. I'm the first one to say that. I don't like his demeanor. I don't like the way he plays. I don't like the shots that he takes. I don't like a lot of things about him. When he's at his best, he's tremendous. But I think that he's a hindrance at this point. But Jalen is our guy. By the way, against the Heat, he's like the only one who showed up, for goodness sakes. He was like literally the only one who showed up on the team. If someone else would have showed up, I think we would have beaten the Heat. And I think we could have beaten the Celtics as well. Not the Nuggets, but
you did have the Celtics swagger. I'll just say, I will say this, though. As someone who watched Kyle Lowry's entire Raptors career, and as someone whose favorite player, or one of his, like, I don't know, 10 favorite players all time is Chris Paul, I think it's really hard to win when you have a guard who's 6 feet and under as one of your main dogs. And when, like, push comes to shove, you ultimately need the guy that has some size and some elevation who can shoot over people and score at their basket. And Jalen's going to have that ceiling. Anyway, I don't want to have you on here to basically trash Jalen. I just thought it was interesting.
Dante DiVincenzo.
Sure.
We're recreating the Wildcats. This is tremendous. Bridges
you guys
is coming
will win
next.
So many college championships if that's the case. Like, you would win so many. No, I just thought it was crazy that whenever a superstar gets rumored to go anywhere, right? Like, your boy, your friend, your close personal friend who you work with, Bill Simmons, has had this like Joel Embiid leaving thing for a little while, and about how the Knicks could get involved and how he could be the guy that goes there. Like, dudes who aren't even on the trading block are always linked to the Knicks.
Isn't this nice that we're not going after the big shiny toy? And also, isn't it nice that we're not being used? It always feels like we're used. It always feels like we're used, like, oh, he might go to the Knicks. And then it's like, there's no chance he's going to the Knicks. So I like what's going on. They have some decisions to make still over the next few weeks. Like, they need to get rid of Fournier. You know, Rose left, cool, but the Randle thing is the real interesting one for me. Do they get rid of him or not? I don't know who's going to take him at this point, but
it's weird.
He would be a nice like third piece for like a solid contender. He can't be the second or first, in my opinion, and I don't even know if he would be willing to be the third piece, but I think that's his ceiling ultimately.
You know what's funny about him is when he was coming out in the draft and people were talking about his wingspan and calling him alligator arms. It's like, that's the only way I've ever seen him now. I'm like, can't win with that guy. No wingspan, alligator arms. Okay, so you and I have been texting a lot this week, and it's because you heard my take on Francis Ngannou. You wanted to hear Canada soccer stuff. I was trying to give you all the goods on Canada soccer.
This is how big of a fan I am of the show, and yet I get like rude, snarky texts back. It's bizarre. I ask for guests. I make requests.
Yeah, I know.
Not only do the guests not come on, then when you finally get someone to talk about the topic that I want you to talk about, you're starting to talk about fighting. I'm like, can I just have a moment? It was annoying. I'm out walking the dog. I'm like, let's see what the boys are talking about regarding Canada soccer, you and James Sharman, who knew he was such a big fight fan. Unbelievable. Yeah. Now you guys are going on and on about Fury and Ngannou and the UFC. I'm like, geez Louise, can I have a break? I got some things to say about Canada soccer. So maybe now you have the fight guy come on to talk about soccer.
Well, I was going
to
say now we should do the soccer thing first. So you're this, I will say this, you are an elite level troll on Twitter. Like you will hit, and I love it because you troll America and you live there and you proudly, you will basically, do you think, what was the Canadian team with Bret Hart? What were those guys called? The Hart Foundation, right? What was the guys after them that did the Canadian thing? There was Lance something Storm, Lance Storm.
Oh yeah. The Un-Americans.
Okay. That's it. Right. You do a little bit of that. You remind me a little bit of Lance Storm and the Canadian guys that came in and would do the heel things. Because you'll do heel Wani wrapped in the Canadian flag, and I love it. And so, you know, I think your tweet was something along the lines of congrats to America on beating Canada's C team, even though America also had theirs. And that's the best kind of troll, because you know you're going to get the reply guys just so angry, like you don't know what's going on, even though.
Oh, that's the best.
Yeah, I know. And I can see it in your face right now. Like, you're so happy knowing that thousands of people just went to that tweet furiously and were upset about it. But man, you really do care about Canada soccer. So do I, quite a lot. But how are you feeling this last couple months or this last month? Because like I outlined it with Charmin, the record throughout June to July has been full of a lot of disappointing results. They have a coach that people have basically turned on. The program is on fire. Like, does this deter you at all in terms of your optimism about the program? Like, how are you feeling about Canada soccer right now?
It's amazing how much can change in a year, right? A year ago, it felt like a fairy tale, and we had already qualified for Qatar, and Herdman were like praying to the soccer gods that he doesn't leave, and he's like our guy, our savior, and we've got Davies and David, and just everything as of Qatar. Like, basically, the Belgium game was fine. Heartbreaking to lose that one. Heartbreaking to see Davies miss the PK. Jonathan Davis should have taken the PK. Ever since his goal against Croatia, everything has gone downhill, right? Yeah. I mean, the Morocco game was a total sham. And they come back. They had the Panama win. The Panama win in Las Vegas was solid. The game against the USA was an absolute joke. They should have lost 4-0, 5-0. The post game was even weirder. Herdman saying that, you know, first of all, saying they didn't have enough time, then referring to the team as Canada, which was very weird, like this disconnect, like he's not a part of it. And I've said this to you, I follow all the Canadian media guys, and it all kind of felt like everyone turned on him as well. And so maybe that seeped into my brain. But this performance now, granted, with the C team, was very uninspired. The Guadeloupe game, the Guatemala game. I mean, these were all really poor performances. This is supposed to be, you know, a CONCACAF giant, and they can't even beat these teams. They can't even score against them, for goodness sakes. Mm. And then, you know, I will admit, I got super excited for the America game. It was a Sunday night. It was perfect. And I felt like we were going to get smoked. And we didn't get smoked in the first half. And then we were still alive with about like 80 minutes to go. And then it was like, all right, this is inevitable. They score, it's done. And then we tie and we're like, holy smokes. And then we go up in extra time. I'm like, oh my God, they're actually going to win. That's when the real like Hiawani came out. And then of course, you know, shot in the heart. And it doesn't feel, I don't know. It's a weird feeling. It's like they've lost all that momentum. It feels like people have lost faith in Herdman. And let's be honest, these next 3 years are arguably like the most important 3 years in the history of Canadian soccer. You're hosting a World Cup for the first time with two other countries, but it's still a massive deal. You're coming off a World Cup. You've already qualified, so you have this massive, you know, runway. You can't qualify for the Copa America, and it just seems like all that magic is gone, and that's very disappointing. And oh, by the way, it also seems like anytime, you know, like our big dogs come and play for us on the grandest stage, like they don't really step up. Davies didn't really step up. David didn't really step up in the Nations League, whatever the hell the Nations League is. So I don't know. I'm very conflicted. I'm hoping that they'll, you know, be able to turn it around. There's several guys on the team that I really, really enjoy watching. I'm big on Ishmael Kone. Buchanan, to me, is a really fun guy to watch. And he didn't start in the first half against America, which I thought was very bizarre as well. I'm not a big fan of the keeper, Borjan. So, like, you know, obviously I love watching them and I love supporting them, but I do feel like they're at a crossroads, and this crossroads has come a lot sooner than I expected, because last year I felt like we were on this rocket ship.
You know what though? This is where you like not only do you prove you're a true blue Canadian still with the tweets and the following of Canadian stuff, but with the insecurity of sport programs like this. Like, you and I have talked about Canada basketball in the past, right? Like, you're still, you texted me a couple weeks ago asking when they're going to announce the roster. And you know why you text me that? Is not because you're like, you're an American guy who doesn't really care about it because you know that you're going to field an all-star team. You text me that because you don't know who's going to actually be there. And it's felt like the momentum for that program has been up and down and up and down. And hockey, we don't even have international events anymore. So it's like not even our thing. So we have baseball, where nobody went. Like, a bunch of the stars did not go to the World Baseball Classic, classic Canadian thing. Basketball, guys never fully commit to it. There's always someone who's either on a rookie deal or doesn't want to be a part of the program or has some kind of drama with it. Like, whatever. We've had a difficult time doing this. And soccer, even though it's one where I think for me, especially as someone who's coming into understanding international soccer as a new fan and not knowing when a guy is supposed to be there versus our guys not showing up here. And with a program that's in flux right now, where there's bankruptcy and coach talk, I get all my insecurities of, are all these guys going to continue to commit to this program the same way? Like, are they all going to pull in the same direction? Are we going to see the fruits of that labor come up in 2026 when there is the World Cup? And I start to sweat and I start to get nervous and I start to get scared. And I think that, like, that's the sort of feeling that you and I are having, is this is a greater sport, like a greater Canadian sports issue than it is just even only purely soccer.
Can I ask you two follow-up questions?
Yeah.
Number one, because you're more of an expert than I am. I know you're having me on the show, but I'm just actually genuinely curious. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that so few players, regardless of sport, are quick to volunteer to represent Team Canada?
I think it's because in those sports, the Canadian kids go down south really early and they start to embrace more of an American. And I don't think that they feel as passionately about being Canadians. Like, I shouldn't say it's about being Canadians, but about Canadian national programs. Like, if you're a baseball player, you're playing maybe college baseball down the States. You're gone from a pretty young age. You're playing select programs. You're down there. Canada basketball, you're down in AAU in those leagues when you're 15, 14 years old. You don't spend a ton of time in Canada. Like, I was even thinking about Josh Palmer, who's a wide receiver who I interviewed for the San Diego Chargers. He went down as a kid to the States when he was 15 years old. Hockey to me is different because kids have a developmental track that keeps them here up until they're in their 20s. And there's so many different things that they stay involved with these GMs. They measure themselves against the other kids in the country. That's what happens in the States. That's what happens in all these other countries. Canada is very unique in that we basically have our developmental systems for three of the major sports south of the border. We're shipping kids off left, right, and center. Yeah. Hey, go down to the States, go down to the States, go down to the States. And then they make it down there. We're super proud of them. And we go, how much does it mean to be Canadian? They're like, I left there when I was 14. Like, I don't know.
A disconnect. There's also this thing where I feel like in America, you know, you grow up and you say, oh, you know, MJ represented the U.S., Kobe represented the U.S., LeBron represented the U.S., Carmelo represented, and it's the same in any other sport where, you know, like the best soccer players, they all represent the U.S., et cetera, et cetera. And in Canada, no one has done it. And so there isn't this thing other than in hockey, right?
Yeah.
In hockey, you're a kid, you say, oh, Lemieux did it, Gretzky did it, McDavid is doing it, et cetera. Here, the last guy to really like go out and say, I want to play for Team Canada in basketball in like a really big way was Steve Nash. Now it's starting to change and that's great. And it's taken like a really long time for it to become a thing, but it just feels like there isn't this pride. And I don't know if it's, you know, the players to blame, the system to blame,
system's
Team Canada to blame. Yeah.
System's a big part too. That's my second part to the answer, is that you look at Canada soccer, right? And they're bankrupt. They just went to the World Cup. They were the only team at the World Cup, Ariel, that didn't have a World Cup kit. They couldn't even get that together. Like, that's how discombobulated they are. They're like, we're just wearing the same kit. I know. And that's it, is you have this combination of guys who don't necessarily have the affinity for these programs like other nations. And then when they go there, they're like, what's in it for me? And Canada Soccer goes, actually, we signed a deal already that going to distribute the money in ways we see fit. And you guys worry about your cut later. And if you bring this public, we're going to portray you as the greedy players, like the ones we're going to leak things like you want World Cup tickets. That's not a good relationship these guys have. And so
it's very contentious,
terrifying, man. And that's it, is like, It feels adversarial in a way. Canada basketball has gone leaps and bounds. Like, I really do think that that is now on the come up, and that is going to change.
They better make the Olympics. They better freaking make the Olympics.
They're going to make it. And like, they did have, they've been baby steps, and there have been step backs and whatever. But now it's just, it's so rich with talent that we're undeniable, right?
Like, it would be shocking. It would be an absolute failure if they don't make the Olympic team. I love Canada basketball as much as I do, if not more than Canada soccer. And it would be an absolute disgrace if those guys can't forget like meddling, which I think they are good enough to be in the conversation for maybe a bronze. If they don't make the Olympic Games again, and these are going to be a tremendous Olympic Games because it's going to be like the first one, you know, post-pandemic, and it's going to be in Paris, and it's just going to feel like good vibes. Yeah, it's just going to feel, I don't know, I'm very excited about next year's Olympics, and I want Canada basketball to be involved. I remember waking up early to watch Steve Nash in 2000. That's the last time we were in the Olympics, and they had a nice little run there in Australia, so... Yeah, I would love to see it. And going back to Canada soccer, like, look, they need to take advantage of the fact that the World Cup is in Canada, because that pressure of qualifying is off their shoulders. And not to get too in the weeds here, but I think it's crazy for the growth of the game.
It is.
That my friends who I talk to about, I'm like, I have a buddy, Jason, who's a big fan of yours, and we're always texting about sports, and he lives in Vancouver. And I'm always telling him, like, Canada's playing Cuba right now. He's like, can't watch it. Can't watch it. I'm like, what do you mean you can't watch it? What do you talk? How do you grow the game? How do you get people to want to dream to be Canadian soccer stars? If it's on an app or something like that, no disrespect. They seem to be doing great. But like, what? These games have to be on terrestrial television. That's how you grow the game. And so all these things kind of drive me nuts. I have an easier chance watching Canada. I could watch Canada against Cuba on FS1 in the United States, and you guys in Canada couldn't watch it on TV. That's crazy.
I know it really is a real issue, and especially like and this is anecdotal evidence, but I'm looking at Twitter the night the Canada USA game is happening, and what do I see? People who cover football, people who cover basketball, people who cover MMA, whatever, all tweeting about the soccer game. You know who is tweeting about the soccer game in Canada? People who follow soccer and who are soccer journalists, because they're the only ones who actually even knew where to find the feed. Mm-hmm. Like, I was texting people asking them, where do I find this? Like, how I work in sports. I'm this is my living, and I couldn't find it. So how is someone who's passionate even supposed to know anyway? So now we saved the best for last here.
Oh yeah.
Which was, So James comes on and he shares his thought, and I tell him,
is he a big fight fan? Is James a big fight fan?
He loves fight. Wow. Yeah. He loves fight game, man. A lot of people, I think that
closet fans,
dude, I would say that, In my experience anyways, there are a lot of people in sports media, you know, you cover these games and they're like, you watch a lot of regular season stuff that doesn't matter. And the beauty of fighting is like, it's always high event, right? And especially when you get big names and big fights, is that it's a Saturday night and it's just like everything matters because you're fighting. You're actually fighting. This isn't like in other sports, they're like, we got to fight tooth and nail. And you're like, no, you got to dribble the basketball. Like game is no, you got to. There's going to be teeth involved. There's going to be nails involved. Actually, hopefully not nails. But anyways, Fury and Ngannou gets announced, and we all knew it was coming. And I said I blame the UFC more than anyone for this. But yeah, I said it's a. I didn't take it as far as like Kevin Ioli's column where he's like, one. Like, sorry, I shouldn't have said it, but yeah, it was bad. It was a bad column. I read it too, and I got trapped by the headline, and I read it, and I was like, ah.
Well, it's especially bad when you read the column when Mayweather-McGregor was announced, which was the complete opposite.
Anyways, it is what it is. But I read that and so I don't think it's quite to that degree, but I'll watch this fight. There's no doubt about it. But like, I like sports because I don't know the outcome, right? I feel like there's a puncher's chance for someone. I don't think Francis has a chance. And so it doesn't excite me in any way other than the fact that this guy got paid, but is he even sticking it to the UFC if he loses this fight in an embarrassing fashion? And then, like, what happens next? What happens if he gets completely destroyed by Tyson Fury? And then what? He potentially has to limp back to the UFC in order to continue his fight career?
Well, this is actually a masterstroke on his part because, in a way, he did this better than Nathan Diaz. Because Diaz, if he loses to Jake Paul next month, his stock goes way down. He has no fallback plan, right? He wants to go back to the UFC. And as I think we talked about, like UFC 300, him versus McGregor, if he knocks out Jake Paul, like he's in prime position to get that. Yeah. Francis already has the gigantic deal with PFL, already signed, sealed, and delivered. So even if he loses, he still has that deal. It's not like, oh, you need to win this fight in order to get, you know, the big MMA deal. So that's number one. Number two, what I love so much about...
Are people going to follow him to PFL, though, and watch his fights if he loses to Tyson Fury?
It depends on how he loses. Yeah, also, like if he goes the distance and you know, like, really represents, I think he'll make some new fans. There's a lot that I love about this, and there's a little bit that I don't like. And what I will say is that, number one, when Francis and the UFC parted ways, the UFC tried to, you know, couch it as he was released. He was not released. His contract was up, but they were trying to hurt him on the way out. Dana White said, this man doesn't want the tough fights. This man is afraid of competition. That we could have like a 30-minute conversation just on what this man has overcome in his life. To say that he is afraid of John Jones when he was openly and actively campaigning for John Jones for 3 years, there's actual evidence of this online, and I know for a fact he tried to make the fight happen, is ludicrous. So people were like, oh yeah, you're a wuss, you didn't want the tough fight, you didn't want John Jones. And now people are like, oh, you're insane, you're gonna get knocked out, you're gonna get embarrassed, you're gonna get smoked, you're taking the toughest fight possible, literally the toughest fight possible in MMA and boxing is Tyson Fury for him, and he's taking that fight. So which one is it? Is he afraid, or is he a guy who's actually going to try to test himself? That's number
a good
one.
Point. I like that. And that is another testament to his character. Here's what I would say, though, is the amount of money that he's getting to fight Tyson Fury. I would fight Tyson Fury for that amount of money. I would.
Not when you talk about, will people follow him? And
yeah,
legacy,
no, you're right. There's
all that
definitely
stuff.
A legacy component to it. But the beauty that Francis does have with his, I guess, from the legacy, quote unquote, standpoint, is no one is expecting anything from him that really cares about fighting. So he does have a very small bar to hurdle over, right? Like, even if thinking back to the Conor McGregor fight, I still truly believe in my heart of hearts that Floyd was not trying and he genuinely bet on himself to win in a certain round. And that's why he played it that way. But remember when Conor landed that one shot that kind of like shook Floyd even a little bit, where he's like, oh, and then he turned it up a bit and was like, okay, I'm putting this thing to bed. I think that Francis just needs a moment like that. If he can land clean with his power on Tyson
and he
Fury,
can. Yeah, he can do it. I don't know if he could ultimately win. He's a long shot. By the way, Alexander Usyk is the guy that everyone wanted to see Tyson Fury fight. He's arguably pound for pound top three. He's the guy who beat Joshua twice.
Yeah.
He's fighting a guy named Daniel Dubois at the end of August. Daniel Dubois is a top five heavyweight. Usyk is a bigger favorite against Dubois than right now Fury is against Ngannou. So everyone who's saying that this is a massive mismatch, Usyk is fighting a legit heavyweight, and he's a bigger favorite, not a bum, like an up-and-comer star, whatever you want to call him. And what annoys me about the reaction to this news from a couple of days ago was people were giving, you know, Tyson Fury crap and Ngannou crap for taking Fury away from the Usyks of the world and the Joshuas of the world. Please be clear about this. The only reason why Fury took this fight is because he couldn't get those fights done. Could have been his, you know, fault, could have been Joshua's fault, could have been Usyk's fault. Ngannou was lucky enough to just be there, and he was like, all right, I'm going to take this one. So Ngannou didn't mess this up at all. I agree with your point that if you want to blame anyone, you could blame the UFC, because the UFC, not only could they have made the John Jones fight, they could have made the Tyson Fury fight as well. They are in business with Top Rank. You know, the toughest part about making the Mayweather-McGregor fight was they had to do business with Showtime. They hate Showtime. Here, the UFC and Top Rank are under the same umbrella. ESPN could have said, hey, guys, please come to the table. Let's figure this out. You have your guy. He has their guy. Let's go meet. Let's fight. And then after this, you could do the Jones fight. Like, they had the easiest path to making this happen, and they didn't do it because they didn't want to co-promote, because they didn't want to give Francis what he wanted. So what did he do? He fought out his contract with a bum knee, a torn ACL. He beats Cyril Gane after being down 2-0. He gets surgery. He sits out all that time, rehabs. They try to sign him. They don't give him the freedom that he wants. He says bye-bye. And then he goes and leaves, and for 5 months is ridiculed. Everyone said he fumbled the bag. He outpriced himself. He's a lunatic. He's crazy. He's delusional if he could get this fight. He gets the PFL historic deal, and then he gets the Tyson fight. And he's getting paid more for the Tyson fight than all his UFC fights combined, and more than the UFC deal to him. How could this be a loss? And I know that we are not programmed to celebrate athletes getting rich. Everyone's rich. Everyone's rich beyond their wildest dreams. It's a weird thing to celebrate an athlete getting rich. But please believe me when I say, if there's one guy that you want to celebrate getting rich, it's this guy. This guy got paid $600,000 as the heavyweight champion of the world in his last fight. He has never made close to seven figures. I am happy he's getting rich. I'm happy that he bet on himself. I'm happy that he's getting the fight that Dana White tried to make for John Jones, because he tried to take the fight away, the opportunity away from him, and he's shoving it up everyone's behind, and he's saying, look, in life sometimes you take the road less traveled, you bet on yourself, good things can happen. Good things happen to a good guy. It's okay to be happy sometimes. And it's okay to not be selfish as sports fans. I know you want to sit down at home with your wings and your betting app, and you want to watch John Jones versus Francis Ngannou. Well, guess what? That was the only fight left for him in the UFC. There was literally one fight left for him in the UFC. And John Jones isn't exactly the most reliable, you know, dance partner. Let the man go out and
one shot in Las Vegas, and it became a national news story. One shot of tequila. I thought he got wasted. I thought it was going to be like a video of him going crazy, and it was just him doing one shot of promotional tequila. And I went, how did this make my newsfeed? Like, how did this get here?
Because of history.
I know. That's what I mean. It's just like, so I'm totally with you. We do have to wrap this up, but I'll definitely want to get you back on after this fight, because there is a greater conversation here too, though, of
that's it. Between July and October 28th, we're not speaking again.
We'll speak again, but yeah. Obviously I'm going to bother you and ask you for more favors, but yeah, the thing that I find kind of interesting here is, will there ever be a tipping point for the UFC where they start to see more people do the Francis model, where they actually have to adjust their business practice? And like, that's the thing that I'm most curious to see moving forward, because I don't want to lose the UFC, an organized body where everyone fights under the same, or all the best fighters technically are supposed to be under the same umbrella, and that you do supposedly see the best fights. But I'm with you. I root for the athletes as well. I don't like it when guys are taken advantage of. I don't like seeing a heavyweight champion who's clearly worth, like, what's Ngannou going to get for this fight?
He's getting in the multi-millions.
That's what I mean. And so for him to be fighting for 600 grand, you can say at home with your wings and your betting app, as you put it, that that's a lot of money for anyone. It's like, no, you're worth what the market says you're worth. And that's what we're supposed to, like, we live in a capitalist nation. Okay. Like, we're not in Soviet Russia. We're supposed to be able to have this thing. So let him make his cash. I root for him. I can't wait to see what ends up happening here. Cause the Logan Paul things, those are one thing. If this continues to be an avenue where guys can get, you know, fights,
it won't be.
You know why? So, eh?
It won't be, because the contracts are too restrictive. That's what's so amazing about this story. He had to fight out the deal, become champion, win that fight, keep the belt, wait a year and a half. Like, so much had to happen for this to actually fall this way. It's actually absurd. It really is. Yeah. It makes you think that there's like some sort of higher power in this guy's favor, because, I mean, look, no one else does this. It's very, very rare. It's extremely rare. So that's what's kind of making it cool, in my opinion. And guess what? If he does shock the world, if he lands that punch, could you imagine? What will they say then?
They'll say, this is now the new Buster Douglas. This is the luckiest punch that's ever happened. Anyways, we got to go. I appreciate your time as always. Ariel Helwani of all things MMA. And of course, now the Ariel Helwani Basketball Podcast, which is also excellent.
Canada Basketball, they're the third or fourth favorites right now when it comes to betting favorites at around plus 900. And that's a little too, I like a bit of a better price, but man, this is so unbelievably exciting. Jamal Murray and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander backcourt. Like, yes, it's awesome that there's some other guys going here, but it's all about stars going for Canada Basketball. And that's their two best players who are going. No Wiggins still would love to see Canada Basketball develop a reasonable big man who can protect the paint. I think that they're going to be missing that a little bit, but tons of Canada Basketball talk over the next couple of weeks, and especially heading into that qualifying tournament. The World Cup, two teams, the top two American teams qualify. I'm so unbelievably happy for Canada Basketball fans. I cannot wait to watch Jamal Murray and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander wear that uniform and play for Canada. Best bets are back. Go to my Twitter and Instagram for tonight's bets. I'll see you on Monday.